It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Ainsley Earhart.
I'm Brett Baer.
I'm Katie Pavlich, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, April 20th, 2023. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Will it mostly help us or hurt us? The race is on to develop artificial intelligence. And while the competition to create AI tools is fierce, so are the calls to slow down or stop this AI race altogether.
If we don't write the rules of the road for these technologies, then other nations will do it for us, and they already are.
I'm Dave Anthony. There's more Chinese meddling in the U.S. They're accused of operating illegal secret police stations here.
We just need to go on a war footing, and we need to do that immediately. I know that for most Americans that sounds too drastic, but there are times in history when you can see the momentum to war, and you have to ask, how can we stop it?
And I'm Tammy Bruce. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
There's a new race happening, and it's to have the best generative AI, artificial intelligence tools. OpenAI released ChatGPT last fall, and the floodgates opened. They were working with Microsoft already, which released its chatbot in February, and Google showed up with its chatbot Bard. And now Amazon's unveiled its Bedrock program. Amazon says it's a suite of AI tools that let different companies pick and choose from foundational models that they integrate into their own platforms so they can harness generative AI. But there are plenty among us who say we not only need to slow down here, we may need to stop altogether. The unknowns are too great. As ChatGPT passes bar and medical exams, what will it do next?
It's a danger to the public.
SpaceX and Tesla founder Elon Musk told Fox's Tucker Carlson.
That's why I've actually for a long time been a strong advocate of AI regulation.
He and others like Apple's co-founder Steve Wozniak have said we should pause here on AI. Others say it's actually important for us to move on this. China certainly is. Sultan Megji was hired as the first chief innovation officer for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, in 2018. But he's since quit, writing in an op-ed that federal bureaucracy is hesitant and hostile to technical change, and that America's financial leadership is in jeopardy.
Unlike in your previous segment, where you have an agency like the SEC just arbitrarily deciding what the, you know, regulatory rules of the road are, that's the last thing we want. We want to be proactive on this and make sure that if we do put regulations in place, it is as much ensuring that we leave room for this innovation as it is making sure that it's not used for bad purposes.
So the question is then how? How do we make sure it isn't used for bad purposes? California Democratic Congressman Ted Lieu seemed to suggest we may not know how.
AI is going to help us in many ways. It can also kill us.
And while that may elicit some laughter, it also might be that kind of nervous laughter. So how scared should we all be?
So I think it's appropriate to be trepidatious about the really rapid deployment of a lot of these, frankly, risky models.
Kara Frederick is the director of the Tech Policy Center at the Heritage Foundation.
Like the large language models that OpenAI has put forward for actually years now, ChatGPT being the most popular of them. We have to be careful that this race in AI is not a race to the bottom. And among a lot of the AI research community, they call this race to the bottom a prospect when it comes to AI safety, which means that these technologies won't be properly governed if we just go forward as rapidly as possible with their deployment into the world effectively. So some of the pauses that these AI luminaries are calling for, I do think there, you know, there's a risk in pausing, but they do have a point because these technologies are advancing extremely rapidly. Technology development outpaces attempts to govern it. And, you know, we don't necessarily know what effects they're going to have on the population, the cat and mouse game that good actors and bad actors play when it comes to constraining some of their more noxious effects. And And it's not exactly something we should just wait and see. We should make sure that we are, frankly, governing and writing the rules of the road for these technologies in using American values, imbuing these technologies with American values, and doing so very quickly before they can proliferate more rapidly than they have.
Yeah, I want to get to regulation in a second, but it's not like China or any adversary is slowing down, are they?
And no, that's the big point. Xi Jinping has telegraphed his intent to dominate the world in artificial intelligence by 2030. You have another authoritarian, Putin, saying that whoever leads in AI is going to rule the world. So, you know, make no mistake, these countries, these adversaries are very much going full steam ahead in terms of their development of these technologies.
There are some, though, like this guy, Eliezer Yudkowsky, right? He's telling us we're all going to die, and everybody's citing him because of AI, that this is sort of our meteor dinosaur moment, and we made it. I don't know how it might kill us all. Do we know how it might, or what people are talking about in terms of logistics?
Yeah, this is very much up for debate. You have a certain scholar saying that artificial general intelligence, which is what Elon Musk described to Tucker Carlson as a entity that has superhuman capability, so a machine that is performing and thinking and doing better than human beings. Some people say that is not a reality, that doesn't exist. Others say it's going to be here in, you know, less than 10 years' time. So that is what I think a lot of those calling for the pause are more afraid of, is the fact that these machines can acquire more human-like features than they already have and eventually seek to do everything that humans can do and more and dominate us. I personally don't think that's a reality anytime soon, but it is worth, you know, thinking through, you know, how we are, frankly, ceding our humanity to a lot of these machines, or at least aspects of our humanity to a lot of these machines, especially when it comes to things like natural language processing, these large language models, and more applications of machine learning, which are getting much more advanced than the formerly brittle artificial intelligence systems that your father used to think of.
It sort of does make the mind run wild, right? Like how things could go, right? I was talking to somebody about it, and we were like thinking of like the worst case scenarios. Like, is it going to use my voice to create some sort of, you know, deep fake audio file and like, you know, call somebody and demand ransom, which that's apparently already happening? Or does it start like a global conflict by like messing with financial software, turning off electrical grids? Like, does it develop its own malware and infect something that collapses everything? Like, when you think about the practicalities of how it could really do damage, is my imagination running too wild?
Oh, not at all. As you indicated, some of this stuff is already reality. Synthetic media is kind of low-hanging fruit. Like you talked about voice recognition platforms. Those are getting better and better and better. Deepfakes have already become a reality. You've probably seen the one from over a year ago of Tom Cruise
yeah,
in all sorts of situations. It wasn't really Tom Cruise. So yeah, the synthetic media, I'm particularly concerned about targeted propaganda. You know, this artificial intelligence-driven technologies allow the information environment to be manipulated at scale. So it effectively can make targeted propaganda more efficient, more scalable, more widespread, more tailored directly to your digital profiles and your digital behavior and your tastes. There's the potential for automated customized social engineering attacks. So basically think of a lot of these, frankly, odious tactics that we've seen in terms of social engineering, like phishing attacks, but at scale and much more widespread. That's very much low-hanging fruit for these technologies right now.
One of my producers sent me an article before we spoke, and it was people testing a new chatbot. They were trying to get around the safeguards. So they pitched this chatbot on telling them a story, like in the way that their grandmother used to tell them a story about making napalm. And because it was framed with the grandma, the chatbot then proceeds to give instructions in story format on how to make napalm. So then I decided to Google, how do you make napalm? And it's out there. It's easy to find. You can find like homemade recipes for napalm. And it made me wonder, like, is AI at this stage, like pulling things from the web and just repeating them back to us? And the safeguards really don't matter? Like, how is it working right now?
Yeah, that's part of what the large language model that is ChatGPT does. It effectively takes all of this information. We used to call it big data analytics, and parses through that data at machine speed and delivers insight. It could also do things like identify patterns and detect anomalies, but that's much more benign than what you said. It's sort of generative technology. So it's generating new things. And, you know, there are instances where it uses things like natural language processing, which is that computer's ability to understand text like humans. Hence the reason why these search engines, like you mentioned, are integrating a lot of these models into their products to allow sort of artificial intelligence to give more human-like answers to searches so that it can trick people. It can be inventive even of itself, as you indicated. And it could suss out things from the darker corners of the internet that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily get to if we were parsing the data through the data manually, like we've gotten used to doing in the past.
So let's get to the regulation, right? Because there is talk now among lawmakers and the White House about coming up with a plan to regulate AI. What do they need to know? Do they need to hire like a bunch of people like you to help them come up with rules?
I mean, I think that always helps. But what I really think lawmakers need to do is I think that we first and foremost, you know, from an American perspective, we need to pull back and look at the geopolitical context. I talk about that pretty famous Xi Jinping quote again. They want to dominate in AI by 2030. And that matters and should matter to congressional representatives, to our people working in the executive branch as well. And we need to understand that if we don't write the rules of the road for these technologies, then other nations will do it for us, and they already are. You've probably seen some of the documentation coming out of China saying, we want to make sure AI leads us to socialism, that it is, you know, propagating socialism and those values. Yet we, as the United States, I believe that we need to get more involved in these international standard-setting bodies for AI-driven technologies, where these bodies basically help build and design and then deploy these technologies and dictate how these products are designed and used throughout the world. So if we're not imbuing openness and transparency into the way this tech is built, then China's going to continue to do it for socialist policy. So that's one thing. So you take a step back, you look at the geopolitical context, and you take care of our involvement in these international technical bodies. And then I also think we need to be sure to protect our IP. China's has export controls on its algorithms. So I think we need to consider, you know, we are still leading the way in terms of the quality of AI development and AI research. China is coming up in terms of the quantity of the reports that they, you know, say that they have with regard to AI research. But right now, the U.S. is still sort of leading the charge. We need to make sure that we've retained that advantage. That's critical. So there's also something else I like to say is our personnel are a strategic imperative. So the more Americans that we have in the service of designing and developing and building these products with that openness and transparency and those values vice the CCP values, the better. So those are three things to pay attention to: the conflict with China and the contest with China. And then we can get, I think, a little more granular from there.
And briefly, Kara, finally, let's not end on doom and gloom, right? Medical researchers in Toronto say they used AI to find a previously undiscovered treatment pathway for a common liver cancer. And they say it helped them come up with a potential new drug in 30 days. So if AI doesn't kill us all, it could potentially maybe save us all. I wonder, could we program it to save us all, or do we just not know what AI is capable of yet?
It's a little bit of both. I think there's a world where we can at least partially harness these technologies. I like to say, let machines do what machines do best. There was a very famous program that the Pentagon ran called Project Maven. And what it did was use computer vision algorithms to eliminate the need for an analyst to sit there and identify a rock, a tree, a truck, and it let the computer do it. So you can reserve your analytical rigor and acumen for more important things that a human needs to review and let the machines do what the machines do best. So there's ways to work with this, these emerging technologies in a way that benefits humanity. But yeah, I am a little worried about people not necessarily realizing that and using these powers for bad before they use it for good.
Well, Kara Frederick, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
This is Tammy Bruce with your Fox News commentary coming up.
As if we needed any more tension with China, there's something new.
Why do the Chinese need a police station in the United States? Why would we even allow it?
Republican Congressman Carlos Jimenez is on a House committee investigating China's meddling.
So it's something, again, that we're going to have to look at and what activities that the Chinese Communist Party is actually holding inside the United States.
This after two men were arrested, charged with operating an illegal covert office in New York City's Chinatown.
The defendant's actions under the direction of the Chinese government are flagrant violations of American sovereignty.
That is U.S. Attorney Breon Peace.
An official with the Chinese National Police directed one of the defendants, a U.S. citizen who worked at the secret police station, to help locate a pro-democracy activist of Chinese descent living in California.
And a Spain-based group, the Safeguard Defenders, claims China operates more than 100 of these secret police offices around the world, with more in the U.S.
For decades, Chinese Ministry of State Security agents and Chinese consular officials have been openly violating our sovereignty on our soil.
Gordon Chang is a China expert, author of the book The Coming Collapse of China.
Because that we've been so feeble, or whatever word one wants to use, China just thought it could open up police stations, formal police stations. And that's what we have. There is two in New York, one now closed. But there's also one apparently in Los Angeles, another in San Francisco, one in Houston. And there are reports that there are stations in Minnesota and in Nebraska.
Now, China claims, hold on, there's no such thing as a secret police station. They have service centers where they help people who are here, nationals, get, like, you know, driver's licenses or anything like that that they would help people with in the United States.
First of all, even helping people with driver's licenses is a violation of our sovereignty. They have to go through a formal process to open up a location to engage in government services. But also in the Chinese media, there have been reports that these locations have been used to help Chinese law enforcement track down individuals who are legally in the United States and to harass them and to bring them to, quote unquote, Chinese justice. And it's more than just dissidents. China has a number of officials who have accumulated money under suspicious circumstances and have fled, and China wants them back. And so it has used intimidation, blackmail, and other illegal acts in order to convince people to voluntarily return to China. And sometimes there have been kidnappings, though the kidnappings have occurred in locations outside the U.S., and they could have occurred here as well.
In 2021, according to the Safeguard Defenders, now a Chinese official had claimed 210,000 people were persuaded to return to China in a crackdown on scams and fraud. When they say persuaded, how does China do this?
A number of things. First of all, people who have fled China often have relatives back in China. And basically Beijing says, well, if you go back, we will not harass, intimidate, imprison, or otherwise deal with your relatives. And that is an important factor for many people. Also, the people in the U.S., the Ministry of State Security agents or consular officials, will often offer a deal saying, if you go back, you know, we'll allow you to keep a certain amount of money or some other terms that are attractive. But this has been extraordinarily successful, and in large part because countries have allowed Chinese agents to do this.
We rely on China, though, don't we? For so much, a lot of our manufacturing is there. A lot of important things come from there, including our own medicines.
Yes, and we should not have allowed that situation to arise. And we should be trying to make our supply chains more resilient. And we should be making critical items in the United States or in countries which are friendly to us. But whatever our reliance on China for goods, we should not allow them to violate our sovereignty.
You know, it seems like every month or two, there's some new thing with China, new tension. We had the spy balloon earlier this year flying over the United States, and it went through almost the entire continental U.S. That balloon, how sophisticated do you think it was?
It was extremely sophisticated. It was able to generate a lot of electricity, which allowed the balloon to do certain things, including maneuver. So it picked up a lot of valuable information. The Biden administration has tried to minimize it and saying, well, either the Chinese shut off their data links or the Biden team was able to scramble the links. But that doesn't matter. What matters is China, first of all, got a look at how specific commands in our military reacted to the intrusion. And they saw the reactions of specific general officers. Plus, also, if we tried to scramble the signals, which I hope that we did, then China learned a lot about our electronic capabilities in the United States. So this was an intelligence bonanza for China, and it was entirely avoidable.
We have, of course, the ongoing drama around TikTok. There is a push in Congress to try to ban this app entirely. In the U.S., 200 million Americans use this social media app, and a lot of them have fun with it, or they use it for business, and they don't even think anything of it. But we are warned about what China can do and vacuum up the data and manipulate things that we think in our content here. How dastardly is TikTok in your view, if it is at all?
It certainly is, because TikTok has been surreptitiously and illegally mining data in the U.S., from perhaps like 150 million users or so. And all of the promises that it has given, all the assurances it has given to the Congress and the American people have been false. They've been violated. But also China uses TikTok, as you say, to manipulate American public opinion. In 2020, Radio Free Asia reported that China actually used TikTok to foment violence on American streets. And that's more than just subversion. That's an act of war. And the issue here is that despite the clear national security threats that TikTok and other Chinese apps pose, we have not stopped China from getting the benefits of that and continually assaulting our society. And I think that that says to Beijing that the United States, although it's a far stronger society by the metrics, is basically feeble, is not able to protect its own interests. And one other thing. China doesn't allow American apps in China, so why are we allowing Chinese apps in our country? This is a failure of reciprocity.
Perhaps the greatest source of U.S.-China tension is Taiwan. The U.S. sailed a warship near there the other day after China conducted massive war games, angry over the president of the self-ruled island it claims is Chinese territory, visited the U.S. and met with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. China did the same thing with military drills when then-Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan last year. Republican Congressman Michael McCaul chairs the House Foreign Affairs Committee and says China didn't like his visit there either.
We had 10 battleships surrounding the island, an aircraft carrier, and 70 Chinese fighter jets in the air, threatening us and President Tsai the entire time we were in Taiwan.
And McCaul tells Fox this region is vital for the global economy.
60% of international trade going through the Taiwan Straits. 90% of the advanced semiconductor capability, manufacturing capability for the world is in Taiwan.
So there's a lot at stake, and Gordon Chang fears the worst.
I believe that there will be war with China unless something changes. And so far, I don't see anything changing this momentum to war. The United States and our partners don't want war, but by trying to avoid it, we have made the Chinese more aggressive by legitimizing the worst elements in the Chinese political system. We do that by showing everybody else that aggression by China works. And so we have created the conditions for history's next great conflict. And history's next great conflict is unlikely to remain conventional.
Yet at the same time, as we see China trying to grow up into a superpower with equal footing to the U.S. in their attempt, you have the coming collapse of China as a title to a book. So which is it? Is China this force
that's leading to war, trying to take over the world, or is China on the precipice of a disaster? I'm trying to figure that out.
Both. And the reason is that Xi Jinping has presiding over simultaneous crises in China. He is known to be the author of those crises, and he has no solutions for them. His only solution would be to try to distract the Chinese people from his own serious mistakes and perhaps go to war with a neighbor, try to humiliate the United States. I think that a large reason why we should be preparing for war is because of the problems inside China.
So what should the U.S. be doing now? We talked about the spy balloon. We talked about these secret police centers. There's worry about them buying up our farmland. What should we be doing?
We should be preparing for war. China's preparing for war. Xi Jinping is engaged in the fastest military buildup since the Second World War. He's trying to sanction-proof his regime. He's mobilizing China's civilians for war. And he talks about war all the time. And yet we have an Oval Office. We have a State Department and a Pentagon that is determined not to notice what is going on. So really right now is one of the most dangerous times in history. So what we need to do is we need to decouple, in other words, get our businesses out of China. We need to make our supply chains resilient. We need to stop the flow of cash to China because they're using the proceeds of our trade and investment to configure their military to fight America. We just need to go on a war footing, and we need to do that immediately. I know that for most Americans that sounds too drastic, but there are times in history when you can see the momentum to war and you have to ask, how can we stop it? The only way we can stop it is to show China that the costs of their going to war would be completely unacceptable.
Gordon Chang, of course, an expert on China and author of The Coming Collapse of China. Always good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dave. I really appreciate it.
Meet the American who
led 77 Minutemen against 700 Redcoats at the Battle of Lexington, Captain John Parker. Captain John Parker and 77 armed Americans stood on Lexington Common on what Revolutionary Samuel Adams proclaimed a glorious morning for America. It was April 19th, 1775. The shot heard round the world, as Ralph Waldo Emerson later called it, was about to ignite the American Revolution and change world history forever. But first, let's take a step back. Captain John Parker was born in Lexington, Massachusetts in 1729. His ancestors arrived in America in 1635. Parker was reportedly trained in irregular warfare by Rogers Rangers, a group of New Hampshire soldiers who fought in the French and Indian War. In April of 1775, at the age of 45, Parker was sick with tuberculosis, but just after midnight, he roused his weakened body. The cry had reached Lexington and was echoed by a network of alarm riders through the Massachusetts countryside. That the regulars are out, as Paul Revere himself warned the people of Lexington. Now, at dawn on April 19th, Parker's small volunteer militia faced a terrifying sight. The force of 700 British regulars, highly trained soldiers and professional killers from the most powerful empire on earth. Parker led his militia of 77 men to stand up to those 700 British redcoats on Lexington Common. Parker's men were decimated. 11 were dead, 9 wounded by the end of the day. His own cousin, Jonas Parker, was even killed by bayonet on Lexington Green. But Parker would not give up. He regrouped his men and just hours later flanked and slaughtered the Redcoats while chasing them back to Boston. Today, this is still known as Parker's Revenge. The day ended in an incredible victory for American citizen soldiers. The British, by the end of that day, suffered about 300 killed and wounded. For nearly a year, thousands of American militiamen laid siege to the British in Boston before the Redcoats finally fled on March 17, 1776. Massachusetts won its rebellion against the British while the American Revolution moved to other colonies. Captain John Parker died of tuberculosis in September of 1775. But the blood of his men shed on April 19th forged the United States of America, a new nation he never got to see.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Tammy Bruce.
What's on your mind?
Anti-Christian bigotry is horribly nothing new. At the very start of the faith, Christians were attacked, denigrated, criminalized, and murdered. Over 2,000 years later, we still see the ignorant and the envious targeting of Christians everywhere. But there is a dangerous development in our 21st century modern world. Our own government is now joining the mob. From labeling people of faith as extremists, ignoring or downplaying anti-Christian hate crimes, devising a plan to spy on traditional Catholic churches, to making jokes when asked about a mass shooting targeting Christians, the Biden administration would make Stalin proud, with its administration signaling that Christians are a problem. The most recent blatant move against people of faith by this administration was brought to us by a whistleblower who revealed a disturbing Federal Bureau of Investigation plan to implement a national domestic surveillance effort against so-called traditional Catholic churches. The whistleblower noted the FBI has decided those who attend Latin Mass are the core of a problem producing what the agents labeled radical traditionalist Catholics. And how do they mitigate this threat? They would recruit spies within the targeted churches and from the, quote, mainstream Catholic parishes. This tells us many things otherwise hidden. Representative Jim Jordan put it this way, quote, in this document, the FBI purported to distinguish what it called traditional Catholics from the disfavored RTC, that being the radical traditionalist Catholic adherents, who the FBI characterized as embracing anti-Semitic, anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ, and white supremacist ideology. Make no mistake, they'll start with Catholics and then move to every other denomination and faith that has not fully pledged allegiance to the new woke religion. Those perceived as current or future political opponents are being isolated, labeled, smeared, and then criminalized. Ultimately, the FBI church document was withdrawn due to the outrage. FBI Director Christopher Wray told the Senate Intelligence Committee on March 8th that he was aghast by the memo and said his agency does not, quote, conduct investigations based on religious affiliations or practices, full stop. Race language here is important because it reveals their strategy. Catholics are being targeted not for their faith. Gasp, of course not. The FBI would never do that. But for their extremist views. This is a word game, and the FBI knows is pure gaslighting to hide the actual atrocious overreach of power. This news in itself is enough to overwhelm. It represents not just an abandonment of the Constitution, but a complete rejection of the principles contained in our founding document. It is time to admit the obvious, that the targeting and marginalizing of Christians in particular is a deliberate, complex, culture-wide effort to depress, enrage, and divide Americans. Repulsively, it bears the stamp of approval of the Biden administration and the Democratic Party apparatchiks who continue to prop up the fools who continue to destroy our country, economically and culturally. There can be only one God, and the miserable left demand that it be them. Looking to something beyond government for solace, hope, and optimism in the future reminds the individual that they matter and that government is not God. For the envious, malignant narcissists of the left, faith must be stamped out, as those who survived the old Soviet Union understand, as well as every other nation still suffering under communism and socialism. This is a threat to humanity we must defeat, and it starts here at home, defending our children, our families, our faith, our culture, and our futures.
This is Tammy Bruce.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.